Do you guys like standing up here and sharing? No. I get nervous too. Yeah. And I'm glad I get nervous because there's a degree to which you don't want to do it too lightly. You want to think about the seriousness of what you're doing. So while you're up here, I'm going to talk to you just a little bit, just a little bit. When you go on an adventure like you guys went on, I think I heard the word faith building. I think I heard people say that God did some amazing things, just the incident of making it through the over the hump quickly and on time. Come away from that, and you know, I don't want to put it trivially, but it's easy to have faith when you're with a group of really neat people rallying around each other all the time. And that's good. It's great. That's why one wants to do those kind of things. I'm guessing that 5 months from now, if that takes us into December, January, February sometime, some of you may find yourself not finding it easy to have faith because you're going to feel very alone. You're going to wish for the old days of summertime, right? When everybody was together and the whole team was there and you could meet each other like several or 20 times a day if you needed to, right? You'll be alone. Yeah, it's January. January's not exactly a happy, happy month anyways. And it's going to be hard to believe. It's hard to believe when you can't quite see what you're believing for. When you feel cauterized in your emotions, when your emotions are just blah, there's nothing there. If anything, just sad, right? Hard to believe then. That's my little opening just for you. The rest of the whole sermon, I think, should fit. So see how it goes. One of the things that has irritated me over time is when I hear people say, just believe, as if there's nothing to it. It's easy. I once heard somebody say, don't think, just believe. I found that very ironic because it involved thinking to say, don't think, just believe. There was a theology of a non-theology, which I find paradoxical, problematic. In the passage we're going to look at today, faith is not easy. We're going to see a person demonstrate a robust and a vigorous faith. And I think it's a good thing because we don't always have times when we're together with a team. We're not always at Cape and Ray, testing 1, 2, 3, where the gang is all warm and enthused. We come home after a while where things are ordinary. So today we're going to look at the account of person I'm going to call the Canaanite lady from Matthew 15, verses 21 to 28, where it describes her action as asking Jesus with desperate, pure, non-entitled hope, trusting his goodness and compassion. We're going to explore how she reached beyond her gender, her race, to an authority figure in a stranger's house, looking for compassionate help. I think she's a model to challenge us. I'd like to look first at the two main characters, Jesus and the lady. As far as Jesus is concerned, what we glean from Matthew in chapter 14 is that he and his disciples at the beginning of chapter 14 have just heard of John the Baptist's death. That's not good news. Well, not good news because they love John the Baptist, but because John the Baptist is going before Jesus, Jesus makes the note of what's coming to him in his future. Jesus withdraws to a solitary place, and then guess what happens? A lot of people find him in that solitary place, and it says that he healed many people. And then after that, he feeds many people. And then he withdraws up the mountain as he sends his disciples off across the water, where the storm gets the boat moving in such a way that it doesn't move where they want it to go. Jesus comes down the mountain, walks on the water. Remember that incident? Peter says, if it's you, bid me to come out to you and walk on the water. Jesus says, come. Peter gets up, he walks, he looks down and says, yeah, some kind of expletive, I don't know. This is water, people don't walk on water. Boom, down he goes. And then Jesus says to him something which is significant for our story. He says to Peter, oh, you of little faith. When they land, more people find Jesus and he heals more people. What do you think of that? You hear that somebody has died in a way that you are going to die. Then you withdraw, people come. Then you withdraw, your disciples are in trouble. And then you meet more people who need to be healed. Was he exhausted or what? In chapter 15, he meets some Pharisees who are nitpicking about how clean people's hands should be when they eat. And Jesus makes a statement that what comes from inside a person is what makes them clean or not, not what's on the outside. Our passage is going to deal with uncleanness of a nature as well. So now to our current circumstance. Excuse me. Just line up my ducks here in a row. I had a friend once in a faculty meeting who was nervous, and he started shuffling his report while he was speaking, and I saw it happening in front of my eyes, and I thought, stop, John, please stop. Don't shuffle your report. Right? This is what you need to focus on. I'll try and stay focused here. So the immediate situation is that Jesus withdrew again, and he went to the area of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon is about 40, 50 miles away from where they were. They were walking. So that would be, what, 2 days? I don't know how many miles you walk. 20 miles? Somebody said 20 miles people would walk in a day in those days. That seems like a long way. Jesus is making a really substantial decision to get away. This is the third time he's withdrawing. He's going to Tyre and Sidon. Mark says Jesus entered a house and didn't want anybody to know about it. So, if you like, private gathering on the outside of the house. Why is he doing this? Well, I'd say why not? Given the context, go figure that he wants to go and be alone, to collect himself, to prepare himself, to contemplate what lies before him, because what happens shortly after this is that he begins his journey to Jerusalem, where he knows he's going to die. So he's preparing for Jerusalem, and some commentators say he's taking the disciples with him to teach them. Well, maybe this incident is a teaching incident. Now to the Canaanite lady. Matthew is very deliberate about calling her Canaanite. If you remember your Old Testament, even if you don't, I'll tell you. In the Old Testament, the Canaanites were the enemies of Israel. They were the traditional enemies of the Jewish people, and Matthew's very deliberate in using this expression. Jesus is moving outside of Galilee and Judea, where he spent all of his earthly ministry, into the Tyre and Sidon region, which is to the northwest of Galilee, along the coast. And so he is in that Gentile territory. He's away from the Jewish people. Mark also describes this lady as being a Greek. And so that's why I'm inclined to call her the Canaanite lady. It's a very thin little branch off the logical tree, but I'm going to put a little bit of weight on it. Now, her personal situation, which he describes right away, is that she has a child that is demon-possessed. I think we want to watch out on that just a little bit. This isn't exorcist language. This is New Testament language. I skim read a 16-page article on demonology in the New Testament, and they really did believe that Satan was an operative force and that there were forces that were out there influencing things for ill. And some sicknesses were understood to be demonic involvement. They, for example, might not have known that epilepsy is what epilepsy is. And so when you see somebody having an epileptic fit, it could be very easy to say that there's something demonic taking place. Now, the author was quick to say that there were many circumstances where evil forces were operative in people. And in Jesus' ministry, there are a number of times where he deals with exactly that kind of situation. So where is this lady coming from? Where is she at emotionally? You have a child that's tormented by the devil. So, what symptoms, I don't know, but it's not good. She's clearly desperate. What kind of night had she had before coming? Was she up with the kid? How many times was she up with the kid? Had she witnessed her child having another horrible experience? How exhausted was she as she shows up on Jesus' doorstep? When I wrote that down in my notes and then I put it in brackets, Jesus and she are both exhausted. Now, what's on her mind regarding Jesus? Mark provides this insight. He says that she had heard of Jesus. Well, what had she heard? And where had she heard it? And is it accurate? Does she think that he is maybe a magician? Somebody who, by some kind of magic, some kind of heebie-jeebies, is going to be able to take care of her child's problems? Like, where is she coming from? Now, we will see that she's not too far off theologically. What did she imagine Jesus could offer her? Okay, now, my last observation about her is this. What barriers did this lady face? First of all, a major barrier. A woman meeting a man. In our culture, it's not really a big deal. But in Mideast culture, it's a really big deal. And with some of my Syrian friends that I occasionally encounter, it's a big deal for a woman to be just with a man, just the woman and a man. So here's a lady who's going to meet Jesus personally, woman and man. Now note, she's also going to meet a person who's in authority. That's also a substantial thing. It's one thing to meet an ordinary Joe, another thing to meet a non-ordinary Joe who's got esteem. Note also that she is a non-Jew. She's a Gentile meeting a Jew. This is going to become very significant in our passage. She knows how she ranks alongside the Jews, how the Jews think of her. And note also, it doesn't exactly say, but she's entering another stranger's territory, a restricted space, to meet this stranger who's a man and who is a Jew, right? So all those things are big barriers for this lady. Now, with that said, let's read the text. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon, as already pointed out. 2 days' journey, big decision, really big decision. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." Strike one, if you're into baseball language. Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came up to him and urged him, I'll use a little tone here, send her away. She's keeps crying out after us. Okay? I don't know. She bugs us. Get her out of here. Strike two. Okay? The woman came and knelt before him. The word kneel is kind of to worship. Worshipped him, and her speech is very short. Lord, help me. He replied, it's not right to take the children's bread. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, back up the truck. Verse 24, and he answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Like, what's that about? Right? Help my child. I was sent the lost sheep of Israel. It almost, there's some movies that are like that. When Jesus talks, the sound goes, wah, 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 and a light comes around to say, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. You know, like what? excuse me, you know, where's the logic of a conversation, right? The woman comes and kneels before him, Lord, help me. I think we're on strike four now. He replied, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Right? Now note what the lady says. Yes, Lord, she said, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall off the master's table. Feisty lady. Wow. Then Jesus answered, feisty lady. He didn't really, but almost. Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. What a story, eh? Wow. Now what am I going to do with it? Is it time to end, Michael? Not quite. Okay, here we go. She comes to Jesus with a desperate plea. She says, have mercy on me. I find that interesting. It's her daughter that was demon-possessed. But I'm a parent. Some of you are parents. Some of you will be parents. When something terrible happens to your kid, it's like it's happening to you. It's awful. Some of us would say, you know, do it to me, you know. Give me the needle instead of my kid, right? Any day. Like, it's awful to see one's kid suffer. So, Lord, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly. Now, it says crying out. The word for crying out is the word ekkratzen. And some people say it sounds kind of the way it is. It kind of sounds the way a crow caws. Ekkratzen, right? She's crying out and not in a calm way. She's and the language is that it's continuing. She cried out and she kept on crying out. She's suffering from a desperate need, her child, and her own pain. Now note how she addresses him. Lord, Son of David. She addresses him respectfully. Now the word Lord can simply mean master. But if you know anything about the Old Testament, the word Lord also is a way of describing God Jehovah. So, Lord, how does she mean it? She means it respectfully. And we get a bit of a clue from the next thing where she says, Lord, Son of David. Okay, now she's using language that's weighted with freight. The expression Son of David is the expression that was used to describe the Messiah of the Jews who would heal the people. So her theology is not bad. I listened to a guy last night give a sermon on this, and he said, notice the prophetic statement that this woman makes. I thought, well, I don't know if she's a prophet. I don't know. That's kind of pushing the button a little bit for me, but she does seem to have some knowledge about whom Jesus is. Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. Well, as you saw from the reading of the text, she encounters some obstacles. First obstacle she encounters is that Jesus did not answer a word. Actually, this is very unnatural, because what we saw in chapter 14, which I just summarized very briefly for you, is that pretty well any time people brought people to be healed, Jesus healed the people. So, like, what's he doing? Why is he quiet? And by the way, like, silence is really powerful. I'll talk to these lovely people again. I don't know, like, some of you might have romantic involvements, okay? Like, don't put up your hand and say, is it I, right? Don't say that. And I'm not being prophetic. Probably being pathetic right now, right? But, like, you know, if you're in a romantic involvement and you want to really teach the other person a lesson, just get quiet. Quiet is really, really, really powerful. Some of your mums and dads know about that all too well. Some of you may have even witnessed that in your mums and dads. We won't go there. That's the sermon in February coming up. Yeah. So silence, no response, nothing. I have a quote from a woman named Madeline Langell, who I really have enjoyed reading. And this is what she says. She says, "I've been often told that when one first turns to God, one is greeted with brilliant yes answers to prayer. For a long time, that was true for me. But then when he has you hooked, he starts saying no. This has indeed been my experience. But it's been more than a no answer lately. After all, no is an answer. It's the silence, the withdrawal, that is so devastating." Listen to this line. "The world is difficult enough with God. Without him, it's a hideous joke." Wow. Now, on another side, he doesn't say anything, but he doesn't say anything. He doesn't say no. Right? So if the woman's listening, she can say, well, just like, again, if you don't mind, some of you were 16 just a while ago, or it's coming. And like if you go to your mom and dad and say, "By the way, can I have the car?" And your dad doesn't say anything. Are you discouraged? No, right? He didn't say no, right? He just didn't say anything. So what this means is that we have to ratchet up the persistence and see if we can squeeze it out of him, right? Yes, he didn't say no. Yeah, well, some of us understand that too, don't we? Okay. So the next thing that we encounter, the second obstacle are the followers of Jesus. They come to Jesus and they say, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." No, it's about them. She's crying out after us. She's bugging us. Take care of her. And it's possible that they're asking that Jesus would heal her. And in healing her, get her out. Like, who wants to be on a retreat where there are people crying out loudly in the background? That's why you go on a retreat, to have quietness and peace. Get rid of the needs, right? I don't know if you guys ever felt that. You talked so warmly about how nice it was to be with the kids, but wasn't it, you have to be honest, wasn't it nice to be away from them too? Right? There's only so much glory one can stand, right? There you are. Right? So the disciples are not particularly friendly. Now, I'm going to skip over a little bit of the next section just to make one point. There are lots of parallels in Christian behavior today. Some of God's people are very easily annoyed by needy people because they think it's just God and us. And like, what are all these strangers doing that I have to get myself involved in? Or some of them just don't get the heart of the gospel and they have an attitude. And I had a little idea here. This may relate to some of you. Just think of this scenario. The youth crisis line planning team became very upset because a troubled youth called one of them personally during a planning meeting, destroying the continuity of the meeting and the workflow. Are you with me? The youth crisis team, and their job is to help troubled youth, and lo and behold, a stupid troubled youth calls up and messes up the planning meeting. Actually, I mean, it's funny to put it that way, but I've been in church a long time, and that's not terribly different from... Well, anyways, let's keep going. lest we apply things before the application. Now we have Jesus' strange answers. The first answer that Jesus makes is this to her. We're not quite sure who he's talking to. The disciples have asked him to send her away. We're not quite sure who he's talking to. One commentator says, is he just musing out loud to himself? One commentator pushes that far, saying that Jesus is at a crossroads himself at this point. Who am I really ministering to? What has God lain in front of me right now? One person said, Matthew 15, there's a decision taking place which is similar to what happens in Acts chapter 15, where the question of what do we do with the Gentiles comes up. Here is a Gentile woman in front of Jesus, and he may be wrestling with that. In any case, he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel, which theologically I think is correct. Jesus did have a limited scope in his mission. It was for only for the Jews to start with. And if one understands the Old Testament correctly, the Old Testament seems to suggest that when God's people are lit on fire, when the Jewish people experienced redemption and salvation, then they would be a light to the nations. That's how it goes. God works with his people, and then it goes to the nations. So for Jesus, this is a question: am I still to relate to the Jews, or do I relate to the Gentiles? I don't know. On a practical level, he only had so much that he could do. One thing that really struck me this time was Jesus' time of ministry was about 3 years. He spent his time in Judea and in Galilee with a very short side trip to Tyre and Sidon. I've worked for the Lord for 40 plus years, right? Like, what have I done? And what has I mean, and that's not the, I compare myself to Jesus. No, not, but like, wow. 3 years with a limited sphere? Unbelievable. And what strikes me is that he is conscious that he has a limited sphere. He didn't go to Athens, and he didn't go to Alexandria, and he didn't go to Rome. Those were the happening place, Ephesus. He didn't go to those places. He stayed in pit stop Galilee, of all places, and in Judea, Jerusalem. The woman persists. She falls on her knees, worshiping him. It's vivid. She continues to worship, Lord, help me, a cry from her parental heart. And then we get this very strange answer. You're going to watch me see how I squirm off of this one. It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. I think one commentator says, like, excuse me, if there's anything that is inappropriate, this is really inappropriate, no matter what the context, no matter what's happening. Who's he talking to, again? Is he just musing aloud to himself? Whew. So, actually, on a certain level, most of us would agree with Jesus. Testing 1, 2, 3. He's making a proverb. You don't take children's food and give it to the dogs. Right? Our church has a program called the Starfish Backpack Program. And kids take home packages of food to their family. And it'd be interesting on a Monday morning to have a kid come back to school and say, hey, how was your weekend? And how was the food? And the kid says, well, I'm really hungry. Why are you hungry? Well, my uncle, right? And I'm not sad. In some homes, it is an uncle. My uncle used the spaghetti that they sent and fed it to the pit bull. Okay? That could make some of us very angry. Both Christians and non-Christians in Abbotsford would say, a proverb, you don't take the food that's meant for the children and give it to the dogs, for crying out loud, right? What are you thinking? So, I mean, but the context, right? You know, you're all smart people and you can make logical deductions. Like, who's the dog in this image? Gentiles. Okay, now here, Gentiles were seen by the Jews as unclean. The dogs were seen as unclean. So, Gentile, therefore, dog. And by the way, if you've been in the Mideast, the dogs are, they're not like the dogs we have here. They are scary. They range around all over the place and they're looking for, it's a different kind of dog. You can see the PR department going nuts over this. How are we gonna work on this particular thing? Now, let me linger with this just for a moment. What was the tone of voice that he used when he said it? What was the look in his eyes when he said it? What specific word for dog did he use? Well, he did use a word for dog, which is different than the normal mangy creature. He used the word for dog, which is house dog, puppy. Okay. And we know from the New Testament that it's really critical to pay attention to words. In Gospel of John 21, a rumor spread that a certain disciple would not die, and then the author of John says, Jesus did not say he would not die. He only said, if I wanted to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? So the Bible's really used to the idea that really precise wording makes a difference. Jesus had used parables before. Jesus had spoken in confusing ways before. The disciples often don't get what Jesus is saying. Jesus and God the Father often delay the answers to things. So as we slide to a conclusion here, what's the lady's response? Yes, Lord, she says, but even the dogs eat crumbs that fall from the table. Look what she does with her answer. She takes in her answer and brings the dogs from outside, these are the puppies, into the household. They're in the household. They're not at the table, but they're just under the table. And we all know, those of you who have pets in the home, we know those dogs get food that falls out there. That's why they're perched there, so enthusiastic and ready for action. They're ready to get that food. Now, she could have had a lot of emotions, hurt, confusion, anger, shut down. Luther says at one point, with the kind of cannons that are being fired at her, that fortress of faith should have smashed a long time ago. Would you have hung around this long? Right? Silence from God? Stupid followers of Jesus? God saying something obscure, strange, perhaps perverse? Would you hang around and say, I won't let you go until you help me? And look what she does, right? She says, hey, speaking of dogs, give me some crumbs. And Jesus says to her, oh woman, you have great faith. Your faith is answered right now. One of the commentators pointed out, I don't know, you have to check this out later, those of you who know German. He uses the expression du three times in this verse, which is very personal. In German, when you address a stranger or somebody that is, you're treating respectfully, you use the word sie. I don't know whether popular German still does that, but it used to be. And Jesus says du, du, du three times. He becomes amazingly personal. And that expression, oh woman, you can just see his heart whelming up with her on that score. Here, I'll read a little quote from Luther. Last night I made the mistake of reading Luther's sermon on this passage. I felt very, very small. Here's what Luther says in this section. See how powerful and potent a thing faith is. She seizes him at his words and turns them around in her favor. You say I'm a dog? That's true. Then treat me like a dog. She traps him in his own words, but he is happy to be trapped like that. What I desire, she says, is nothing more than the right of a dog. I'm not a child. I'm not from the seed of Abraham, but you are a rich Lord, and you spread a glorious table. I'm just like a dog. I don't wish to sit at the table. Just let me have some of the crumbs that you and the children don't need. And with that, she traps him. Yes, she not only wins the right of the dog, but also the right of the children. Where else can he go? He's trapped himself. He must relent. Now, that's Luther. I'm not saying it, but I find it really intriguing. By the way, when Jesus says, oh woman, what great faith you have, see what happens in that statement. He elevates her to the same place that we have for Abraham. Paul in Galatians says that Abraham was what he was because he was a person of faith. Well, I got to end. And so there's an application for you. Well, there's lots of applications. Actually, one protest. Some of you may be sitting here and you have a right to be sitting here feeling a little uptight. And say, hey, look, I have prayed, and I've prayed really hard, and I've trusted God really hard, and God has not answered my prayer. This passage makes my experience trivial. And I hear you. I've thought about that for the last 3 months as I've been hovering over this text. I understand that, praying really hard for something that doesn't happen. It's part of my own life experience right now as well. Scripture needs to be listened to stereophonically. We're listening to one of the speakers right now. If Michael wants, next Sunday I'm available for Habakkuk chapter 1, where the other speaker of the scripture is on.
And that speaker starts off in Habakkuk chapter 1, where Habakkuk says, "How long, O Lord, will I cry to you and you don't answer?" So there are two sides. There are two sides. Both are true. So two things that you can do this morning in response, and the worship team can come up as I mention these. One thing you can do is be moved to repent. As I've been looking at this passage steadily, I look at myself and say, "Oh man, Lord, there's so much more. My faith is so skinny compared to this woman who's from outside the fold." Then secondly, we can be inspired by her to earnestly seek God and his kingdom rule in our space and time. Pressed by obstacles of silence, insensitive Christians, and then God's oblique way of connecting at times, are we willing to ask? Now notice, ask, then seek, which involves more action, then knock, which involves persistence. Are we willing to be a pit bull like this lady, clamp on to Jesus and his goodness, and not let go? So here's two verses. "Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." And Jeremiah 29:13, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." May God enable us toward that end. The prayer team is going to come up, and if any of you wish to repent with them or to even ask God for renewed vision, "I believe, help my unbelief," please do it this morning. Thank you, Jesus.